Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Happy weekend to you, and welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to center the child in all conversations about marriage, family, and beyond. I'm glad that you joined us over this lovely fall weekend. For those of you that are not living in the areas of the country dealing with extreme weather or the aftermath of extreme weather, I hope that you are enjoying the turn of seasons. I certainly am. I was in Washington, D.C. and Pennsylvania over the weekend. And I will tell you, it was glorious. It was absolutely glorious. And I so love visiting different parts of this country where we tend to find people who love God, love their nation, and are working to train up their children to make it better in the future than it was even in the past. It's always such an encouragement to me. And personally, I am much more of a fan of pumpkin spice than lemonade. I like sweaters better than shorts. So generally, this season is a season that brings me great joy. As you know, if you've been here before, we typically start out this radio show with a bit of Bible time. We're not talking deep exegesis. I'm not going to be a stand-in for your chapter and verse pastor. But what I love to do is I love to see what the Word of God says as it relates to our immediate moment, whether it's our cultural moment, our political moment, or simply as it relates to our worldview. And as you know, I am going through Exodus. Now, I have been through the plagues. I have looked at each of them in depth. I am now at the place where they're instituting the Passover, and it's all so deep and so rich and so glorious. But here's a few things that stood out to me over the course of chapter 11 and chapter 12. First of all, God announces what he is about to do. He is about to say that the final and most horrible plague is going to come upon the land. And he says, all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. And then he says afterwards, against none of the children of Israel shall a dog move its tongue. So the idea is nobody's going to have any doubt or any question that God has executed judgment. And then that judgment is wholly righteous. Nobody's going to qualm or worry or debate. I don't know if we should let the Hebrews go or not. They're going to say, get out. Get out. Don't just get out. Take some gold and silver and get out. And a few of the things that jumped out at me is at this point, you've had nine different plagues that have touched every phase of nature, mineral, animal, vegetable, human. And we're getting to the point now where people are going to die, and not just people that are going to die, children that are going to die. And it's interesting to me that in our world, I think that there can be a lot of complacency when we see the destruction of our natural world, when we look at the way that we might be degrading or destroying the environment or the planet by, you know, needlessly polluting. We look at how we are degrading our planet in terms of resources or energy or minerals or fossils. We look at how our economy is being impacted and we are grinding under increased pressures related to inflation or high taxation or the great burden of debt that we're facing. And a lot of us can tolerate it for a while, but there is something that snaps us into action, and it is when they come for the kids. There's something about when a wicked and perverse government comes for the kids that we tend to reach our breaking point. And certainly that was true for the Egyptians, who knew without a shadow of a doubt that they could no longer pass the buck. They could not pretend like they were not complicit, or at least their leadership was not complicit in the horrible victimization of an entire people group that was going to then implicate them and their own children. And that was enough to, in essence, change the mind of an entire nation of people. So I think that that's really similar to where we are today. I think a lot of us have put up with an awful lot of encroachment into our life, our financial life, maybe our cultural life. You know, we've seen the terrible programming or the highly sexualized content that has come across Netflix. And we've said, oh, I'm not going to watch it. I'm just going to turn it off. We've seen how there's been institutional capture in our universities as it relates to CRT or the intersectional hierarchy or a lens that views America as especially oppressive. And we said, okay, well, that's fine. I'm not going to support those universities. I'm not going to send my kids there. But now we're at the place where the direct harm to kids is so obvious that it's snapping a lot of us into action. And I actually think that that is good and right and true, because there is a point where all of us need to say, this is enough. And that point certainly should be when they come for and when they target the kids. So we're going to move into our time of talking about trending news, some of the issues that are on our radar as it relates to and as it intersects with marriage and family. And to do that today, I am welcoming on board this radio show my engagement director, Patience Sunny, who does a lot of the legwork to get ready for this program. She is sort of our policy savant. She understands all the ins and outs of different legal decisions, legislative processes, and she's got her finger on the pulse of the issues. So, Patience, thank you so much for joining us on the radio show this week.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have put together a nice slate of issues for us to address. And the first thing that you laid out for us is the fact that we all have put a lot of attention on the upcoming presidential election. Obviously, this is extremely high drama. We've talked about the presidential debate, the VP debate. We have talked about the different softening, let's say, of the GOP platform and the top GOP candidates as it relates to life and family. But there's a lot going on in November beyond just the top of the ticket. There's even more going on in the election beyond just candidates that are on the ballot. And you brought our attention, my attention, really to major ballot initiatives. You laid out 12 different states that are going to be voting on ballot initiatives that directly impact children and families. So tell us a little bit about what's going on with our ballot and our voting beyond just who we're going to elect into office.
Yeah, so a lot of people don't realize that their state also has a constitution. So these ballot initiatives are constitutional amendments to state-level constitutions. So the U.S. Constitution, there's a process for changing that. It doesn't happen very often. But on the state level, typically what happens is the legislature will pass proposed change to the state constitution, and then it gets put to the voters, typically during the general election. So there's a number of states that have various ballot initiatives, issues ranging from, you know, the environment to education to life and family. But, you know, just looking at these life and family related issues in these 12 states, there are 10 states that have abortion related initiatives on the ballot. And then two that actually have marriage questions on the ballot, which may be a little surprising to people. You know, it's 2024. Wasn't this decided, you know, by the courts back in 2015? So starting with the abortion initiatives, what most of these abortion questions that are on the ballot are doing is proposing a right to abortion under the state constitutions. So when the Dobbs ruling came down, a lot of state level laws against abortion that had been blocked by the Supreme Court under the Roe Doctrine suddenly went into effect. And so it brought a lot of attention to, you know, what's going on at the state level when it comes to abortion. And with that came a push from abortion activists to enshrine abortion as a right in the state constitutions. So what this does then is it makes it so that you can't just pass a new law in that state to reverse that constitutional amendment. It becomes the standard by which future legislation is weighed. And then the only way that a state that has a constitutional right to abortion in their state constitution, the only way that they can reverse that and have pro-life legislation that actually gets upheld is if they first re-amend their constitution to walk that back. So in Arizona, go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, that's a really helpful explanation, because you're not just deciding on we're going to institute this law. Well, we're going to make this change. What you're saying is, in essence, it gets cemented into the DNA of the state. And so it's, after that, you can't just pass whatever legislation you want in the future, like a bill to protect children's rights. If there's an absolute right to abortion, for example, in a constitution, mm-hmm. you can't say, well, we're going to limit this to first trimester or second trimester. No, you are not going to be able to pass laws to change this at all. It takes it to a whole nother level. It almost makes this unassailable. And so, you know, you point out that while both sides can pass initiatives, like both sides can propose different changes to be put into the Constitution, you talk about how this tends to not go our way, our being people that are fighting for children's right to life or right to their mother and father. Why is it that these efforts tend to lean progressive and sometimes succeed?
Yeah, so we have seen that these efforts do lean progressive. Immediately after Dobbs, Ohio and Kansas both had ballot initiatives dealing with abortion, and the pro-life side lost in both of those states, even though they're traditionally fairly conservative states. But what we're seeing is a variety of things. One is that the electorate does lean progressive on these issues, but then also there's a lot of misinformation on some of these ballot initiatives, sometimes just low information voters. They're not paying attention to these extra questions at the bottom of their ballot. And the way that this gets framed, the other side isn't acknowledging this is creating an unassailable right to abortion. This would mean abortion through all 9 months. And so people are just saying, oh, well, you know, I want women's right to choose in some cases, which is where most Americans fall on the issue. Most Americans lean towards some abortion, but with limits. But they don't realize that these ballot measures would mean abortion with no limits and also no future limits. And one of the things that's striking is that a lot of these states actually have parental notification and parental consent laws for abortion that are on the books. And those laws would be completely wiped away by these ballot initiatives. And suddenly, the parent's ability to say, no, this isn't going to be in the best interest of my child. This is a life-altering decision that ends the life of a preborn child, and I'm not going to let my 15-year-old do it, that's suddenly taken away. And the parents don't even have a right to know that their child is pursuing an abortion.
So this is definitely dangerous territory for the unborn, but also dangerous territory for minors that are seeking abortions. And I know that there have been victims of human trafficking that have spoken up against these kinds of bills that would remove parental consent, because a lot of times that is a safeguard against a trafficker wanting to have them get an abortion so they can continue to abuse. So if you're in the states of Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Maryland, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, New York, and South Dakota, open your eyes and pay attention. You've got something on your ballot that has to do with enshrining a right to abortion, or at least pushing abortion forward in your state. Now, there are two other states that are actually making some movements to further cement a definition of marriage that denies children their mother and father. Can you briefly tell us what's going on in Hawaii and California?
Yeah, absolutely. So, it is kind of surprising that we've suddenly got marriage questions on the ballot. But one of the things that's really striking is that, you know, after Roe, pro-lifers didn't say Roe has the last word on abortion. But after Obergefell, the 2015 decision that ruled in favor of same-sex marriage, a lot of people have treated that as the final word on marriage in Christian and conservative circles. But what's interesting is that progressives haven't, and that's why these initiatives are on the ballot. So in Hawaii, there was a legal battle back in the 90s over same-sex marriage that eventually resulted in a constitutional amendment that was added through a ballot initiative that says that the legislature has the power to reserve marriage to opposite sex couples. So it didn't say we're protecting marriage as between one man and one woman in the state constitution, but it did say that's up to the legislature. Well, in 2013, Hawaii passed the Marriage Equality Act that was reinforced in 2015 when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of same-sex marriage. But this constitutional provision that gives the legislature authority over the definition of marriage has remained in the Hawaii Constitution. So this initiative in Hawaii is looking at removing that language, saying that the legislature no longer has the power to define marriage as between one man and one woman. And the reason that people are pushing this first is, part of it is to drive voter turnout. If you say, hey, LGBT rights are on the ballot, that does drive turnout among certain groups. But the other reason is that There are people on the left who are concerned that maybe someday Obergefell could be overturned. And if Obergefell is overturned...
Patience, I got to jump in there because we're going to take a quick break. But I do want to talk about what's happening in California. The bottom line is the left is not going to stop. And we need to stand firm on behalf of children. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Thanks for giving us some of your weekend. We were just talking about some of what is going to be on the down ballot when you look at your ballot in November. It's not just the president. It's not just the vice president. It's not just about the elected officials in your respective states. There's also important ballot initiatives that you're going to be voting on. And some of these have pretty significant implications for children. I'm here with my engagement director, Patience Sunny, and she just ran through some of the importance of what it means if we are going to change our constitution, our state level constitution, and why that is such a threat when whatever we put in the constitution works against the rights and well-being of children. That is certainly the case with some of the abortion initiatives, which are being put on the ballot in 10 different states. But there's also two states, Hawaii and California, that are voting on marriage. Patience just gave us a run through of what's happening in Hawaii. But California is also taking some steps to codify, and I would say even further blur the lines on natural marriage. So Patience, give us a summary of what they're doing in California on the ballot this November.
Yeah, so California's ballot initiative is really quite radical. What it's doing is it's repealing Proposition 8, which defined marriage as between one man and one woman. But it's also including this very broad right to marry as an inalienable right under the California Constitution, listing it alongside life, liberty, and the right to pursue and obtain safety and happiness. So what this broad sweeping provision is doing is it's opening the door to the complete redefinition of marriage, not just at opening it up to same-sex couples, which is already legal throughout all 50 states because of the Supreme Court, but potentially a much broader redefinition of marriage, polyamorous marriage, potentially even incestuous or even child marriages. Because if you're saying that everyone has this right to marry as an inalienable right, it's going to be really hard to put limits on that. And we could see some really terrible things unfolding in California as a result.
Our good friends at the California Family Policy Council has been valiantly fighting against this. You know, they were able to write the no description in the voter guide and worked very hard to make that both accurate as well as drive home the seriousness of these changes. Like you said, in Hawaii, the idea that, oh, we're going to defend gay people will be a tool used by the left to turn out votes. But what they are seeking to do, especially in California here, is not redefine marriage, but obliterate marriage, obliterate
exactly.
It. Simply to say that there are no standards, there are no conditions that should limit what constitutes a marriage. It absolutely becomes truly, in the most absolute sense, a vehicle of adult fulfillment with no connection, no kind of provision or protection for any of the children of those unions. Further, you know, as we talk about a lot of them before us, when you redefine marriage to remove permanence, to remove the complementarity of male or female, to remove the expectation of monogamy, all of which this California bill, this California initiative would do, you are directly harming and implicating the well-being of children. Any form of marriage redefinition ultimately is going to victimize kids. So it's very important what's happening, not just at the top of the ticket, not just in terms of who you're electing to office, but you, the voter, you, the citizen, have power. Power to implicate, to implement, and to encourage laws that are actually going to enshrine justice for the least of these. Justice, especially on behalf of children. Children that are citizens but don't yet have the right to vote and protect their own rights. That is your job. It is your job to use your vote to protect the rights and well-being of the most vulnerable. So there is another area of American life where the most vulnerable are being horribly, graphically victimized. And that is the area of so-called transgender treatment. The treatment that we are giving minors for gender confusion or gender dysphoria, the treatment that surgically and chemically alters their bodies. And many of us have been sounding the alarm about these so-called treatments for years. But recently, a new nonprofit watchdog called Do No Harm has actually revealed this new database, this new data on who is harming kids and how much money they are making doing it. So they are revealing these new numbers, and it just came out this week. So patients, give us a rundown of Do No Harm and what it is that they found as it relates to who is offering these transgender treatments and how much they're making and what kind of harm it's doing to minors, to children under 18.
Yeah, so Do No Harm is really driven by that principle of, you know, in medical ethics, first do no harm. It has been the driving principle behind medical ethics for many, many years. And then along comes the transgender movement. And suddenly doctors are being expected to violate that and to do harm. And what's really troubling is, according to this Stop the Harm database that Do No Harm put together, 225 hospitals are engaging in these gender transition so-called treatments, including sex change surgeries, puberty blockers, and cross-sex hormones. And their database shows that 14,000 children have been subjected to these treatments over the course of the past 4 years. So from January of 2019 to December of 2023, they documented that 13,994 minor patients have received gender transition treatments. So 5,747 of those were sex change surgeries. And just to reiterate, you cannot surgically change someone's sex. Someone's sex is rooted in their DNA. It's immutable throughout their entire life. What these so-called sex change surgeries do is they remove healthy body parts from, in this case, minors, children. So double mastectomies for teenage girls, and surgeries that are really genital mutilation of children, and can't be reversed. So
let's just do a quick drill down, because obviously this is horrific. I really think, and I'm not the only one, that we're going to look back on this in 10, 20, 30 years as the lobotomy, the lobotomy of our age. But we're not doing it on, you know, largely middle-aged women. We are doing it on children. We're doing it on minors. Exactly. We're doing it on kids that could not consent to getting a tattoo or smoking a cigarette. But we are amputating both of their breasts. Let's just be very clear of what we're talking about here. Puberty blockers is using off-label hormones to block the natural development of children's bodies. Puberty blockers does not block puberty, as it is often promoted. They will say, well, this is a pause so you can figure out what you want to do. Puberty blockers actually induce a state of sickness in a child's healthy body. Children are required. We need to go through puberty for the sake of developing our muscle, our bones, our brain, our heart, our major organs. Every part of a child's body matures to the level of adulthood through this process of puberty. It's not just that you ensure that a young boy doesn't develop an Adam's apple and you keep his genital organs at the size of a 9-year-old and not a 19-year-old man. You actually are halting all of development. And that is why we see a lot of the kids that are on these transgender treatments have things like memory loss, brittle bones. They're much more likely to suffer heart attacks because their bodies have not been allowed to develop the way they should. Then a lot of these kids are saturated in cross-sex hormones. Little boys are given incredibly high doses of estrogen. Girls are given high doses of testosterone. This will wreck their bodies. This is a chemical cocktail on kids to the magnitude of 100 times larger than something like a birth control pill that we know already affects girls dramatically in terms of their mood, in terms of their susceptibility to depression and suicide. But we're going to give boys 100 times that amount of a hormone that is much less familiar to their bodies. And then ultimately, children will be encouraged or forced, I would say, because you can't really consent to this when you're 14, 15, 16, into having their healthy organs removed. We are really talking about lifelong loss for kids. So it's stunning, stunning that this many hospitals, over 200, have participated in this, and that 1,400 children, minors, and keep in mind, like those of us that move in this space of fighting for children's right to an intact body, we're told over and over, oh, this doesn't happen. We don't do surgery on minors. Yes, we do. So I'm really grateful that Do No Harm has, in essence, blown the whistle on a lot of the abusive, lucrative practices that are being directed at our kids, honestly, simply to advance an ideology that might benefit adults in terms of their ability to virtue signal about being on the right side of history or supposedly championing the cause of the oppressed. But what they are really doing is mutilating and damaging children for life in ways from which they will never recover.
Absolutely.
Patience, next up, you have compiled an interesting data set, interesting point that families are leaving progressive states and cities. Now, I live in a very progressive state and a very progressive city. I'm in Seattle, and there seems to be an exodus of people, parents with young children from those cities. Now, I can tell you, I see it. I see it in the Seattle public schools that talk about how many school buildings they need to close every new school year because they don't have enough students to populate them. Some of that is because the parents are like, you can't have my kid. Even though I'm broke, I'm going to homeschool them. But I know a lot of people that are simply fleeing the state. So tell us about that kind of trend that we're seeing in a lot of these large cities.
Yeah. So, there's kind of two parallel trends that have been documented here. The Economic Innovation Group found that the number of young children in America's cities is rapidly declining. So the nationwide 0-4 population has decreased by about 4% over the past 3 years. But the decline in urban areas has been much more pronounced, dropping 18% in New York, 15% in Cook County, which is where Chicago is in Illinois, and 14% in Los Angeles County. So families are choosing to leave cities. And then in addition, the Institute for Family Studies recently documented how families with children are migrating out of states like California, New York, Minnesota, Oregon, and Illinois, and moving to states like Idaho, Montana, South Dakota, South Carolina, and Florida. A few things going on there. The analyst who published the Economic Innovation Group's research noted that the decline in families in cities would also likely lead to a decline in what he calls mundane amenities families care about, such as schools and playgrounds. So it kind of becomes a chicken and egg thing then, where families are leaving urban areas are becoming significantly less child-friendly and then less attractive to families. But I think there's also more going on when it comes to anti-child policies that are in place in some of these states that people are choosing to leave. So I lived in Minnesota for many, many years and have recently moved out of the state, not because of politics, but because of life situation. But one of the things that happened shortly before I moved out of Minnesota is that the government decided that they have the authority to remove children from their parents' care if those parents say we're not going to gender transition our kids. And so if I had kids, I would consider that to be a compelling reason to at least question if Minnesota is a good place to raise a family. And it's interesting seeing Governor Walz saying that, you know, he makes Minnesota such a child-friendly place. But the reality is families are choosing to leave states with this kind of policy. Families are choosing to leave states that have unaddressed crime and that have unsafe neighborhoods. So even though, you know, Minnesota has been highlighted for their paid family leave policies, but you know, no amount of Brad Wilcox and Lyman Stone said no amount of child tax credits will be more valuable to a family than safe streets and decent housing for middle class earners. And I think, you know, I would add to that, no amount of tax credits is going to be enough to offset the risk of what if the state decides to take my kids because of how I parent them. And I think that's also a significant driver here.
Yeah, I'm sort of, because I am like one of the seven conservatives left in Seattle, like that's a slight exaggeration. But, you know, the conservatives, we know each other, we can find each other. And I will say I'm probably somewhat of a hub of the conservative underground. So a couple of years ago, somebody found me and passed a dad on to me who's he was a Muslim immigrant, and his highly depressed, suicidal son had been taken into custody by the top four, the hospital the very, very top of that gender transition machine that we highlighted in the previous news segment, Children's Hospital here in Seattle. They had taken Mendicare because he was at risk of taking his own life. And then they said to him, oh, the real problem is that your son is actually a daughter. And we are not going to release your daughter to you until you consent to gender affirming care. And he was absolutely in a panic because, like, my son is not a girl. He will harm himself. What are you doing? Why can't you give him the help that he needs? And, you know, after consulting with me and several others, the path he decided on was to call them and say, I love my daughter. Thank you so much for caring for her. I'll sign the documents. Please release her to me. And they did. And within 24 hours, he was over the state line and into Idaho and has not set foot in Washington State again. And so I think that you're right, that beyond just the incredible cost of living, the fact that it is painful to fill your tank with gas, the fact that you are constantly fighting back progressive lies in the school system, that your kids are having to sort of duck and weave around the broken glass in the parking lot near the playgrounds because the windows have been smashed out, and if you're walking along the street and you walk past the bus route, you are seeing the people that are slumped over. There's a very specific kind of slump of drug use that I've never seen before, but there's something about, you know, the current drug trend that makes people slump over in a sitting posture. I mean, like, we all know this. And you're right, like, it would be nice to have a little bit of financial relief, but the real issue is not necessarily, are we going to make it financially here? It is, you know, the calculations that the people in my world are making about whether or not to stay or go is, will my kids die? Are they going to be captured? Are they going to be, you know, sucked into a life of drugs? Are they going to be over-sexualized? Are they going to get an actual education? Yes, cities are not as child-friendly. I travel a lot for my work. I speak all over, and I've had the joy of going to South Dakota a couple times, and I've met several people who formerly were Washington residents who now live in South Dakota. There was this one dad who's like, I made a spreadsheet of all the places that were the most friendly to children in terms of, like, permissiveness for homeschooling, support for homeschoolers, ease, you know, low tax rates, easy to buy a house, generally good school district. He's like, there was 50 different items on that spreadsheet. South Dakota was at the top. That's why we live here. Okay, there's no mountains, there's no ferries, there's no water, there's no green. It's brown and flat, but my wife and my children are happy, and we're so grateful that we get to flourish. Thanks again for joining us at Them Before Us Radio. Up next, your questions and my answers.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Thanks for joining Them Before Us Radio. As you can tell, there's a lot happening in the world impacting children related to marriage and family when it comes to demographic changes, when it comes to the political decisions that we're going to have to make, and when it comes to our medical establishments. And in all of these different areas, kids need champions. Kids need us, the adults, to put them first. Kids need us to defend their rights, to understand their perspective, and advance what is going to elevate their well-being and their thriving. We need to do that in matters of culture. We need to do it when it comes to voting. But we also need to do it in our own personal lives. And sometimes it's hard to know exactly how to do that. So we devote the last third of our show to just answering your questions. What does this look like in real life? How is it that we should apply these principles of putting kids first to our real life world? To help us with that endeavor is my training director, Jen Friesen, who has had a chance to compile some of the questions that you have sent in over the past week for us to answer on air. Jen, welcome back, and tell us what you've been hearing this week.
Hey, everyone. Hey, Katie. Thanks for having me back. First question, definitely complicated. It's from Peter. He says, my wife has been asked to be a surrogate for one of her closest friends who's had multiple miscarriages and cannot conceive naturally, it seems. We don't have any children of our own yet. What are the main things I should talk to my wife about?
Well, obviously, the big contrast here is Who is the victim? Who is it that deserves our supreme empathy? And it is clear that your wife's friends who have not been able to have a baby have suffered. They want something that they desperately long for. They want something that is good and right and healthy. They want a baby. But it's very important to delineate that who is actually going to pay the price if your wife does accept their offer or their request to be a surrogate. It is not the adults who are the victims. It is the child who is the victim when we get these kinds of questions wrong. So how would the child be victimized if your wife was to serve as the surrogate? Let's say that this couple supplies their own sperm and egg. They create children in a petri dish in a laboratory. They select the embryo that they feel is the most likely to implant, the one that is most likely to survive. The reality is that process typically involves deselecting a lot of children that the medical establishment or maybe even the couple themselves would deem less desirable, whether that is because they might have some kind of possible genetic condition. They look like they may not be as fit as the embryo that is chosen for implantation. Maybe they are the wrong sex. So just that one little embryo making the transfer very often is built upon a lot of other little embryos who don't make the transfer. So beyond just the child that is going to be implanted in the surrogate, that process usually involves a lot of child victimization, and those children deserve our empathy. Those children are the real victims. But even the child who is given the chance of life, let's say that they do survive the screening process. They do survive the thaw if they were frozen. They do survive the transfer. That baby is now going to be at increased risk of things like preterm birth. Surrogate pregnancies are inherently risky pregnancies. There are many more things that can go wrong with a pregnancy. Some of that is because there are technological origins here that work outside of a woman's natural system. The surrogate is going to have to take all kinds of injections dosing on hormones just to get her body prepared for what a woman's body would do naturally through the course of intercourse. And then even after that, there is higher failure rates of children that are implanted into surrogates. We don't know all of the reason why, but genetic dissimilarity, that is a woman carrying a child who's genetically unrelated to her, may play a part of that. So overall, the baby is going to be subjected to not just risks, but also increased medical problems, even if they are born alive. But let's just say that there are no medical risks and the baby is born full term, even then the child is the victim. That baby is going to need to lose a relationship with the only person they know the day that they are born. And do you know who that is? It's your wife. That baby has no idea that your wife is not the genetic mother. They have no idea that they were created in a laboratory. All that baby knows is that your wife is their mother, the only person they want, the only person they know. It's her body, it's her voice, it's her smell, it's her milk, it is her presence that lowers the baby's cortisol levels when the baby is distressed. It is her body. It is her embodiment, her personhood that actually levels the child out and soothes them and calms them. Surrogacy specifically, intentionally, and usually commercially severs that critical relationship and hands the baby over to, at minimum, genetic parents that the baby doesn't know yet. But very often, surrogacy hands the baby over to adults who are not genetically related, either one or both of them, and then out into a world where they are going to be raised in households that are more risky, much more higher levels of abuse and neglect, just because a contract was signed at the right time. So unfortunately, even though your wife may have a desire to help her friends, and her friends' desire for children is noble, what surrogacy is, at its heart, is forcing children to lose their right to life or their right to their mother, their birth mother, so adults can have something that they want. And that is an injustice. Jen, I know you spend a lot of time answering questions about surrogacy, especially on our social media. Anything you'd add to that or additional thoughts?
I think something that stands out is the fact that they don't have any children of their own. And, you know, sometimes they look for surrogates, or I wonder, sometimes there's a requirement a surrogate has to have a child of their own first because they want to see if the product's going to come out quickly, easily, and carefully, right? And, but, you know, potentially the woman could lose her ability to have children ever in the future. And we've talked about the hormone, like testosterone decreases when the wife has a baby. But I don't know if some of those things are true when it's not the dad's baby, you know? And so there's these different levels of caregiving and just interaction as the adults, in addition to all the things you said about the violation of the rights of the children. So these are really important things to consider.
You know, it's interesting because you're exactly right that most official surrogacy contracts and guidelines require that the surrogate have at least one child of her own. I think another reason is women bond with their babies. And it is hard for a lot of those surrogates to let go of the babies. And so in the sort of calculation of big fertility, if she has another 2-year-old or 5-year-old or 7-year-old at home, when she has to relinquish the baby that she is bonded to, that she already loves, that she desperately wants to nurse, and she has to hand it over, at least then she can turn her attention to the child that's in her home and direct some of that nurture and care towards her existing child. So I think that they see it really as a bit of a insurance policy that the woman will not keep the child that she very likely would like to hold on to if there wasn't a contract and penalizations in place were she to act on those maternal impulses.
Right. All right. This next one is from Francesca. She says, we want to foster and adopt, but in our state, it seems like it's becoming increasingly hostile to people of faith or even just folks who are not in agreement with the gender confusion that's captured many of the institutions. Should we even pursue adoption in this setting?
Great question. Who should pursue adoption is a really good question. The answer is not people that want to complete their family. The answer is not people struggling with infertility who feel like this is a way to have the children that they want. Who should adopt? The people who are called to adopt. The people that recognize that this is not about them, the adults. This is not about what they want for their family. This is about the child. This is about protecting the child. This is about seeking to mend the wound of a child who has lost their mother or father. So if you feel that calling, if you feel that burden, if you are going into the process of adoption because you want to shoulder the load of a child who has lost their mother or father, then yes, you need to pursue that. You are right. There are some states that make that much, much harder on people who are principled, people that are biblical, people that actually believe in child protection, not just in terms of seeking to mend the wound of mother or father loss, but also seeking to protect children's bodies from things like transgender treatment, seeking to protect their mind from things like graphic sexual content in schools or in library books or a drag queen story hour or whatever. You are right that in many states, they're going to be hostile towards you. I don't think that's a reason to stop. I think that you go through that process, you seek to become a foster parent or an adoptive parent, you do so with your integrity intact. Maybe you will not be able to move forward with that process without lying or compromising, in which case, before you simply pull out of the process, I would recommend contacting Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF, who probably has some resources in terms of standing up for your rights, your conscience rights, your religious rights, as it relates to a variety of different things, including adoption and foster care. But it might not end up being possible. I don't know, depending on your state. But I would say do not let the possibility of them having a bias against you stop you from pursuing what is very often a life-saving measure or an avenue of redemption for these children who are in desperate need.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was just going to say, it seems like we need more people who are willing to use the resources at our disposal to fight some of these legal battles as well. And like you said, it's for the best interest of children, not to make a political point or to get a law changed or something, but children need to be adopted. And if we're willing to do it, maybe some of us need to go fight that battle. Mm-hmm. All right. Last question from Liz. What is the best way to get someone to read one of your books? I have so many people I want to get on board with this movement, but I think even handing them the book might offend them.
Well, humor can always help. I remember a friend of my neighbor's had found me on Instagram and was angry that I oppose things like IVF or that I am an advocate for traditional marriage. And for a while, like, wouldn't even like let my neighbor talk to her about me. And all. I mean, it just really hostile. But then I think that she saw something, some reel that came across and went, maybe I can kind of see where she's coming from. And so then I met this friend and she said, I would like to read your book. And I said, oh, well, that's really sweet. Do you want my book that's going to trigger you? Or do you want my book that's going to trigger you? And she totally laughed, you know, because everything that we're doing as it relates to defending children's rights in marriage and family or raising kids that are going to buck the woke trends are going to offend some people. And so I think like being relatable and being humorous is a great way to sort of diffuse that. In terms of like, how do you make that sort of cold call? Like, I want to say this to a friend. I don't think that you ever go wrong being an expert on the subject. Like, if you know that there is a certain aspect of this that you think is going to intersect with their life, for example, maybe they're considering divorce. Or for example, maybe you know they still have that crusty old equal sign on their bumper from HRC from like 2012, 2013. Kind of figure out like where is it that they have the highest degree of interest or maybe the highest degree of friction between the worldview of championing the rights of children and what it is that they care about and that they're passionate about. And then study up on it. Be prepared. And then I have this prayer that I pray when it comes to feeling like I need to have difficult conversations when I don't want to, which is 100% of the time. I never want to have the difficult conversation. But I will say to God, look, I know you want me to say something here. I don't want to start that conversation. So what I want you to do is I want you to tee it up. I want you to literally have them beg me to tell them what I think about this. And then when they do crack that door open, I will walk through. I will still probably do it with fear and trembling because I don't like conflict. But if you respond to that prayer request and you open the door, I am going to speak up. What about you, Jen? What have you heard? What have you learned in terms of getting this information to people that you think needs it, but might not necessarily ask for it?
I advised this to one of my friends who was thinking about recommending some of our resources to a friend she knew would not agree with some of it. And I said, I think saying, hey, I don't agree with everything from this book, or here's some things I thought were really challenging and I wasn't sure what I thought. Do you want to read it and just tell me what you think is really helpful? Finding a place you agree with your friend and maybe not necessarily everything that the organization has written would be a good launching point and say, hey, would you read this book together? And then I'll do a plug for our small group curriculum because it's a way to go through material together and say, let's just think about these things. We don't have to agree, but let's just engage with it, have a conversation, answer some questions and see where we come out.
Mm-hmm. That has, we have the book. The book is quite a commitment, especially the first book. It's every chapter of those 10 chapters could have been their own book. I mean, there's a lot of content there. Not everybody is a book reader. So we created our small group curriculum that takes all of the content from the book and puts it into a very digestible, accessible, low barrier format. If you go to thembeforeus.com, if you go to resources for churches, you'll be able to click on that. You'll be able to get access to everything for free. We have a church that funded the creation of these videos. Great resource. And it's the only thing that we have at Them Before Us that actually layers on biblical principles over the top of our social science, natural law, testimony, heavy work defending marriage and family. So it's a great way to understand, not only is this a matter of child protection, this is actually a mandate for Christians. This perspective of protecting children in all areas, but especially marriage and family areas, is God's plan A for child protection. And child protection is a mandate for all believers. And that is what you're going to get here at Them Before Us every week. I'm so grateful that you give us some of your time. Have a wonderful week, and we will see you next Saturday.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.